welcome to In Her Corner, a podcast dedicated to celebrating and empowering women working at every level of sport, on and off the field. I'm your host, Lisely Satali, and today I'm really excited to introduce today's guest, as she's a woman who gave me my real moment of validation when she reached out to me on social media after having seen me launch my podcast and giving me faith to be able to tell her story. It's the absolutely inspirational Andrea Corbett. Hello, Andrea.
Hi, Lisely.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. And thank you very much for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. It's an absolute pleasure. As I said, you gave me my first moment of being like, oh my gosh, thank goodness. I'm not just some mad lady who's just decided to record my podcast alone in my room and in my home because I'm in lockdown. So, and I just wanted to take this moment to just tell the listeners about you and what you do so that they can also get a flavor of how amazing you are.
Can I just add to what you've just said about your podcast? In fact, someone guided me to it. So there's two of us that thought that you're doing a great job. So it was like, they said, I think you need to be on this podcast. So that's hence why I contacted you. And when I saw your bio, I said, yeah, I definitely need to be on your podcast. So that is amazing. Who am I? Gosh. So I'm Andrea Corbett, as you know, and I'm... God, when I have to answer this question, I get stuck a bit because where do I start? So my background's in education. I am a qualified secondary school teacher. I'm also a British champion bodybuilder. I am a social enterprise, founder of a social enterprise called Focus on Creating Your Ultimate Self, CIC. I am a performance and mindset coach. I could probably go on a lot longer, but I'll stop there.
I think it's safe to say you're generally an all-round empowering boss lady.
Definitely.
I think that is how I think about you when I think about you.
Yeah, and so, I wear that crown with pride now. Like before, it's like no. Like yes, I am. I cover all corners.
I love that. So just to sort of like could have tracked back there because I want to talk a lot more about, you know, your background coming into education and then setting up Focus CIC, and then obviously your bodybuilding, which really absolutely fascinated me as a scenario. You know, I've really had to kind of learn and educate myself in because I didn't know a lot about it. And I think a lot of other people listening will be equally intrigued. But I just wanted to kind of go back first to understanding what was your route into sport and physical activity? Like, what was that initial memory that made you fall in love with it and made you think, like, this is a space I belong in and I can really do something in?
Well, unlike most people who get into sport, that, you know, they can tell the story of back when they were young, I can't do that. So when I was young, I used to watch my friends on the sidelines. So when we used that Borough Championships, it's like cheering them on. And so I really wasn't into sports. It wasn't until 2015. So my love for bodybuilding or physical activity came then when I was diagnosed with a mental health illness. And basically advised to use physical activity to manage my health in general and subsequently manage my mental health. And so that's really where it began for me.
So I think that's so interesting what you say, because there's often a relationship, sadly, with a lot of young women not being in sport when they start out. And then them kind of seeing that as that's the end. There's no route for me further. But what I really love about your story is that you found it in a moment where it's least likely to be seen. And when you were an adult, right? So how did you find that initial first experience of being introduced into physical activity? Because you went from sort of what I would call 0 to 100, right?
Real quick.
So you went from like not doing anything to doing something and then going on to be a British bodybuilding champion. I mean, can you just talk me through how is that mental process of getting into there? What was your initial like reaction to having been introduced to doing some sort of form of exercise?
So when the doctor first advised me to use some physical activity, I thought, okay, so you just diagnosed me with a mental health illness. Are you now saying that I have a weight issue as well? And because that was my association with physical activity, is that you do physical activity because you either want to lose weight or that's it. That was it. That was all my education was about physical activity, if the truth be known. But what I did do was I thought, you know what, I'm going to give this a go, because if he's saying that this will help manage my health and my health was in a bad state, and not only was my health in a bad state, my relationship with my son was in a bad state. And as a mother, you want to, you will do whatever you can in order to get back to the level that you were before you, you know, whatever happened, happened. And so that was it, what it was for me. It was a case of, okay, I'm going to try this out. Let's give it a go. What have I got to lose? I've already lost quite a bit already. So that's exactly what I did and why I actually got into the physical activity. And like I said, it wasn't something that I could see why it would help manage my mental health, let alone, I could understand like my general health, but I didn't understand how it would help my mental health. And lo and behold, it did.
Yeah. And just to talk through a little bit more of that, I think you say a couple of things there that I think are kind of very much ingrained in our societal attitudes, right, to do with exercise and mental health. So I want to just kind of take a little moment to unpack them. So the first one there was about how exercise for you was very much associated with being overweight or unhealthy, something that was kind of like a cure for people who were doing the wrong things from a lifestyle perspective or a health perspective. And then the second one I want to just kind of touch on, which I think is still very much a live debate and something we've not quite got our heads around in society, which is the role that exercise plays in mental health, you know. And so just to start with, the first part of my question is really to say, how did you find the getting over the initial sort of barrier, let's say, to exercise, which is that you were like, okay, I'm not overweight, but I'm doing this in order to better my mental well-being and also just to feel physically better. How did you get over that?
For me, it was a case of like just going there and trying it out. And I did that and it really wasn't connecting with me at the time. But luckily for me, I was able to be in contact with people that were doing the sport of bodybuilding. And that for me was my way in. And that was, for me, was my way to actually stay in the gym. Because I've seen that they were there all the time and they had something to focus on. And where the point where I was at in my life, I didn't have anything to focus on. I was off work on long-term sick leave. As I mentioned earlier, I am a school teacher. So at that time, that's when I was employed as a school teacher. And so it's like that had been my life, obviously, apart from my son, that had been my life every day, each and every day. You know, I go to work, I come home, do what I got to do, and then back again. So not having a focus was really, really hard for me, despite the fact that I was really sick. I still was in, it was ingrained in me to have a focus and have a goal.
That structure, right? And that routine and that sense of purpose of every day.
Definitely. And so for me, that's where it all started from, you know, having that goal, having a purpose. And that, so that's where, why I'm really strong about having goals and having a purpose in life. And like he's mentioned, or like I mentioned in the beginning, it wasn't something that I had from a childhood. It was something that I began at age of 38. So for anybody listening and thinking, you know, oh, I can't start something because of my age, no, it's if you're passionate about something and if it's something that you want to do, I always suggest just giving it a try.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think it's something about that initial like starting point, right? Everybody starts somewhere.
Definitely.
And it's comfortable with that beginning. And so when you started to get this new sense of belonging and improved mental health in terms of your association of going to the gym, how did all of that make you feel?
I always say this. So when I talk about going to the gym in the first instance, it was making me happy. And I say happy in such a quiet voice because my lack of education was that, you know, with a mental health illness, you can't be happy, which is a lie. You know, it is so untrue. And so going to the gym for me was like my safe haven. It was a time for me to actually forget about my diagnosis. And the people in the gym were not interested in my diagnosis because having a mental health illness is not something that is external all the time. So people didn't even know why I was off work sick. So I wasn't being judged for having a mental health illness. I was just there because I was there to train, just like they were. I belonged there because I didn't stand out, because I, you know, I didn't have a label on my head saying I'm here because I want to train. And that for me helped me so much, because No, I wouldn't say everywhere. Obviously, I was off work, so I was off work because of my health. Mm-hmm. And I think what I wasn't doing was because of my health. I wasn't visiting my family because of my health. No one actually knew why I was actually at home for a very long period of time because of my health. But when I was in the gym, I didn't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
You know, and so for me, that was like, wow, I found a space that I don't have to think about this illness for at least that period of time. So that was why I was in there so much. I would take my lunch there. I'll just be in there. Obviously, my son be at school for all day. So I was, whilst he was at school, I was just there. And it was actually helping me to become, I wouldn't say a better mum, but become the mother that I needed to be again for my son.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that's so important. And we'll go on to talk about this a little bit later on, but within the Black female community, and generally women, I would say, not just Black women, there is this kind of thing that we don't allow ourselves the permission to take time to look after our physical well-being, which then helps our mental well-being, which then helps us in our daily sort of challenges. So whether that's being a more present and involved mother, a more present and involved partner, or to chase our career ambitions, right? We somehow have been conditioned to believe that those things are mutually exclusive. And I think as well, what you said there is so pertinent about mental health and being happy. Again, there's this kind of stigmatized view that when you have a mental health issue, it immediately means that you have one mode of emotion, and that mode of emotion is unhappiness, and that there can't be anything associated with it that you can help to elevate yourself and move. And I think that's what I love about what you did there. That so when you kind of like moving forward, talk through your body building journey, because I found this story so fascinating when we first connected. So how did it come about that you thought to yourself, okay, I'm exercising now, I'm getting stronger, I'm feeling better, my home life is, you know, improving, I now want to take it to that next level and actually compete? What was that trigger?
It was like, it was all of that all at once. There wasn't any like, let's do step one, let's do step two, let's do step three. It was, I'm going to the gym, I'm going to train, and I'm going to compete. And that turnaround was in like a matter of weeks, literally, because like I said, the people that were there, they were actually training for competitions. And so me being me, I was very inquisitive. So I went away, done my research. There was actually a competition about 3 months later. And I said, you know what, that is going to be my goal. And like I mentioned earlier, I'm really big on setting goals. And so for me, it's like, okay, I'm in the gym, I need a goal, this is going to be my goal. So my goal was to compete in a national championships, and that's exactly what I done. And
not the Olympics, Andrea, why not the Olympics? I mean, whilst you were at it, what's that?
Only because I didn't think bodybuilders in the Olympics, but trust me, if it was, I would have been there at that time. And I'd done the national championships and I won. Like, so it was a case of, okay, this actually works. And so that was great validation for me. And I think with bodybuilding, you know, you're in the gym, you're training, but it's not just something that you're doing for your mental, you can actually see it in your physical. So my body was transforming as I was going along. So it didn't take me a long time to see the transformation. And so once you start seeing the transformation, it's like a bug, you just want to keep going. And so for me, that was what was, one, it was making me happy, two, it was my safe haven, and three, I was doing something for me for once. And that is something I had never done. I've never had a hobby. Like I mentioned earlier, I wasn't into sports when I was younger. So this for me was something that didn't involve anybody else. Like I didn't have to have a friend to come with me to do it. It wasn't for my son. It wasn't for the pupils at work. It was for Andrea Corbett. And so that for me was, that sealed the deal for me. And yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, no, so great. And what I want to talk about is that it's something that's so heavily documented, right? And we had a really good discussion about this, is that process when you are preparing for competition, what your body goes through, what you mentally go through. So in that first competition, obviously you're gearing up for it. As you say, your research has been largely looking online, observing a few people. What was that journey like for you? How was the reception between your family and your friends to you doing this? Because obviously the transformation is very physical. You can't hide it. So how do you deal with that in-between moment?
Well, that was, in the beginning, it was hard to handle because, as you can imagine, I'm dealing with the diagnosis of a mental health illness. Then I'm dealing with my body changing, and I've never seen a muscular woman before. And I can see why when people do see me, they do look at me like, okay, you look different. Because it was new to me when I first started. And so can you imagine my family now, especially my parents, seeing my body changing? That's something that they've never seen me do. And one of the funniest moments was when my mum, we go to on a Sunday for dinner, and like, Mum, I can't eat this week. Like, she was really offended, and I had to explain to her that I was prepping and the types of foods that I can and can't eat. And it got to the point where she actually came to the gym to visit me so she could actually see for herself, like,
I love,
what is this bodybuilding thing that you're talking about, you know? So yeah, she really took an interest in identifying what it was that I was actually doing and why I couldn't eat her food. But saying that was a positive, but at the same time, I did have to deal with a lot of negative comments about my look, it, you know, body shaming, basically. For a moment, I did go through a slight, how can I put it, like negative issues about my own body. I was on the verge of actually stopping bodybuilding because of these comments. Because I didn't know how to respond to them with the issues that I was going through anyway, which were already negative. And then friends, family telling, you know, what man's going to want you, what black woman do you see with have muscles? It was like, wow. And my mindset was in a low place anyway. So my inner critic was already telling me negative things. And so it was like, do you think this is true, Andrea? You know, that whole talking to yourself type thing.
Like, self-talk that comes
maybe,
in.
Yeah, maybe you should need to stop. Maybe this is right. Maybe they are, you know. And I really questioned it a lot. And like I said, I was on the verge. But luckily, I maintained the fact that, do you know what? It got me to a place where I could actually mention the word happy. It got me to the place where I've won a competition now. So clearly, something is going right. So that's when I first learned how to deal with negative comments and the whole resilience aspect of life. So that actually taught me a lot as well.
Yeah, no, I can imagine, because I mean, growing up, my sort of like, and you and I spoke about this, the experiences of seeing women who were highly visible, who were not, let's say, in inverted commas, the conventional feminine shape or size, were the likes of Serena Williams and Amalie Mauresmo, because I grew up and loving and watching tennis. And when you look at the rhetoric, particularly around Serena Williams more than, you know, Amalie Mauresmo, I would say there was a lot of like body shaming 100%, but also this vilification of the idea that a woman could be strong. And I think it ties into, you know, it was rooted in two things that I think you probably sadly had the bare, unfiltered experience of suffering, which is sexism and racism tied to one. This idea that, unfortunately, because there's lots of negative preconceptions about women in general in society, and particularly when it comes to our body form, which is this hugely spectacle that is on, gazed upon, scrutinized, and over and over again in every walk of life, no matter where you come from. But then you add that layer of complexity of being black, and these are a lot of things actually within our own sort of cultural subgroups, right? So myself being an African woman, looking at how the rhetoric is around women's bodies in that culture, it's definitely not celebrated that a woman is strong and muscular. That is seen as bad. She's trying to be like a man, she's not enough of a woman. And all of that kind of rhetoric and language is really also quite, I think, when I kind of look back at it, also one of the main reasons why girls don't want to get into things like strength training and sports, because they feel like it makes them less womanlike.
Yeah, no, definitely. Because even when I started to personal train, and I'm jumping ahead a bit, I get women that say, I don't want to look like you. I was like, babes, I don't take it offensive because not everyone wants to be muscular. I understand that. But that's what they think. As soon as they lift a weight, poof, yeah, this muscle is just going to come from nowhere. And it doesn't actually work. Yeah. Exactly. It would save me a lot of time and pain. But I think it's such a shame. And I feel like, I know we're probably going to touch on this a bit later on, the whole young women and girls, the disproportionate amount of young women and girls who are in sports, who are inactive, it's because of things like this. It's because, unfortunately, they could be hearing people like myself being spoken to, and they could be seeing these things happening before their very eyes. And it is a big shame. It is a big shame. And people should really be careful about what they say. And like I keep mentioning, it's like, not only did I have to deal with that, then I had the coming out of having a mental health illness, which, like I mentioned, it wasn't something that I mentioned I told anybody in the beginning. So then it was, then the narrative was, oh, are you doing this because of the mental health? Is the mental health making you do this? Basically, they're trying to say, like, I wasn't in my right frame of mind because I went into bodybuilding because of the, it's like, no, I'm doing this because I'm actually quite sane. I'm sane. I'm fine. Yes, I've been diagnosed, but I know what I'm actually doing, So they were then twisting it. It was 2015 was a year that really, it made me see a lot of myself and it made me see a lot of other people, and not for the good.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah.
And fast forward 5 years and 2020.
Look at me now.
Yeah, you're thriving. And it's so interesting that you're thriving in a moment where, sadly, a lot of the world is in a lot of visible pain, right? Mm-hmm. Pain that you probably experienced in a very personal way on your own back in 2015 and probably have had to revisit parts of, right, with the recent pandemic and how that's affected people's mental health on a large scale, like we've not seen probably before in a public forum. And then even added to that as well, the anti-racism movement and people's reaction to that and emotions. So how do you use your techniques, right, and everything you've learned to channel through these difficult moments? And what is your kind of sort of main coping tools for that?
Well, it's taken, like, obviously the last 5 years to really get to grips with what tools do I need in my own toolbox. And I'm so grateful that I've been able to build a set of tools for my toolbox, because now that has enabled me to now help the people that I help. But what are they? It's literally the resilience. Like, having the resilience it makes a big difference. And people are like, well, what is that? And people have to build their own resilience, because resilience means different things to different people, depending on what you have actually gone through. And so resilience, confidence, self-limiting, just creating a belief system for yourself. I believe that is so important, because with all these negative comments that you may get from the media, from family, from friends, you need to have your own belief system. And so that was something that I learned, like I mentioned, early in the stages of me going through what I went through. It's just knowing that, although I've been through so much adversity, I like to say, like, I've turned my adversity into my advantage. And just that brings a big smile to my face, because then it shows me, yes, I've been through a lot, but I've come out of it at the other end. And so throughout this time now, through what we've been going through, it really didn't faze me, to be fair, because what I had gone through before was, for me personally, this was nothing in comparison. And for me as well, when I was going through what I was going through, I was going through that. Now we are all going through this. So we can lean on each other. You know, yes, we're all going through, like, the Black Lives Matters. So we can lean on each other for that. We're all going through COVID. So we can lean on each other for that. But when I was going through my mental health illness, I was going through it. So I feel like that's why it hit me harder. And that's why I'm able to now have a better coping mechanism for this year that we're going through now. And that's why I'm able to help more people now, because of my lived experience.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think it's that thing about the difference between having that sort of personal anti-fragility that you've learned and coached yourself in, right? And you specialize in coaching women in and young girls. But then also, I think looking back at that now to say, now everybody is almost sort of catching up, and this kind of needs to be a collective form of group resilience and support that happens. So just whilst we're thinking and unpacking about group resilience, and that, do you want to tell us a little bit more about specifically Focus CIC that you set up and what you're doing with those groups there? Because I've been following you guys and looking at all the different makeup of women you've got, all from different backgrounds, different, you know, religion groups and stuff, and the girls and the young people you're helping. You just want to talk more about what your motivations for that were and what kind of learnings you're getting from that? Because I think right now people who are engaging in different projects around sport are probably having a lot of people come in who are struggling from different walks of life. But what I really love about your model is that it's built and rooted in something every organization is trying to bring in, which is diversity, equity, and inclusion. But you had it at the bedrock of Focus CIC. You deliberately went out and recruited these different women. So do you want to just talk about the process of how you did that and what it's taught you?
Well, Focus CIC was set up by myself in 2016. So the year after I was diagnosed, and people say, wow, that was soon. It literally was because I wanted to give back all what I had learned about the benefits and importance of the physical activity and the education that I had learned about mental health. And so it was advice to me, or not even advice, but someone suggested, you know, have a CIC, and I didn't know what it was. Did my research, and I thought, you know what, this is something that I can put together. So I did that, and Focus actually stands for Focus on Creating Your Ultimate Self. And what that means is, when I started to do that, focus on creating my ultimate self, this is when things started to flourish in my life. And so when I wanted a name for the organization, it had to be something that was very fitting, and it would resonate with not just myself, but other people. And, you know, you're always getting told, oh, you need to focus on this. You need to focus. And so that's where the name come from. And like I mentioned, it's about physical activity and mental health. And now we're in the fourth year, coming up in October. And during this period, you say recruited, I actually didn't recruit. The ladies that are there now, the team that we have now, actually came, they navigated towards myself because they saw what was happening and what I wanted to do with Focus CSC. We all have the same vision. And yes, we're from different ethnic backgrounds, but we have so many things in common. Like, we all have to do with physical activity, we're personal trainers. Another lady, she's a teacher. So we all want to have the better, sorry, just getting stuck there. We all want to see young women and girls do better, have better, especially when it comes to physical activity and mental health. And so in the last few months that they've come on board, which I'm so grateful for them for, we've turned into an education center now. So we are now able to deliver the Community Sports Leader Award Level 1 and Level 2. And now we're also looking into delivering, being able to qualify young women and girls, especially BAME young women and girls, in gym instructor and becoming a personal trainer. Why? Because I know for myself, especially when I first started bodybuilding, wow, I found it hard to see anybody that looked like me, any black women that were in the industry. I'm not saying that there isn't any, but I just didn't see them as regularly as I do now. When you look in magazines, There are few and far between. You know, we may have more so now because of what's going on with Black Lives Matter. But when I look back in all the other magazines I have, there isn't anybody that looks like me. And so imagine how young people feel growing up and not having any role models. And so we've come together now as a collective to be those role models. And it really warms my heart, because it's not just me. It's, you know, we've got, like you mentioned, we've got women from different backgrounds. And so wherever we work with, any young girl we work with, they can have someone that represents who they are and have a role model that looks like them, you know? Yeah. And I feel that's really, really important. And so, yeah, we, and as I mentioned about statistics, where, you know, young women and girls are disproportionately lower, but then BAME young women and girls are even lower still, you know. Yeah. So, and when we say BAME, I'm primarily talking about our Black and brown girls that are particularly lower as well. So us doing that Focus CIC, we really want to see big changes being made, and we got to start somewhere. And I'm so happy and proud of that we're able to start at Focus CIC.
Yeah, no, for sure. And just before we carry on talking a little bit more about that intention of making sure you had very visibly representative role models working in the job, I just want to, because we've got I've managed to get an international audience, Andrea. It's really exciting. So I want to just make sure that we kind of deal with a couple of terms that maybe don't cover very well. So when we talk about CIC, we're talking about a community interest group, right? So this is a community that's founded on the principles of being collective in one single mission. So in Andrea's case here, it's around empowering people through form of physical activity in order to better themselves mentally and physically. And then when we talk about the term BAME, it's a definition here in the UK that is used by government and statistical bodies that sort of do the census to measure statistics relating to people who belong to the following ethnic groups: Black, Southeast Asian, and other minority ethnics that are a mix of either being Black or Asian. So basically anybody who the British government or any sort of formal institution here in the UK does not regard as being Caucasian. That would tend to be formally what we call the BAME group that Andrea's work largely focuses on targeting. So yeah, so Andrea, sorry, I had to do that little bit there because I'm just conscious that I hear all these podcasts and I'm always like, oh, there's so many different terms and I don't know what they mean. So I apologize where we had to be in. So just looking back at that sort of deliberate intention that you had back since 2016, right, to make sure that you had those women in, because, you know, you can't be what you can't see. And I think it's a really important topic that, you know, the sports industry, particularly in a media setting, myself, you know, included working for a broadcaster, we need to do a much better job at representing women that look different from different walks of life in a positive way in association with exercise. So I think one thing I found really powerful there that you said is that until recently, we didn't see a huge amount of coverage of Black women like you bodybuilding, being athletic, being apart from sort of, I would say, the placeholder, the people who are always there, which is the Serenas, mm-hmm. the Venus Williams, the Simone Biles, etc. Those are the people, and we don't really have a great frame of reference here in the UK specifically, right?
I was just about to say that, yeah.
One thing that's really come across to me that's become so visible, right? Because I think the closest we get here in the UK are people like Katherine Johnson-Thompson, Jessica Ennis, the likes of Heather Watson. But we don't have really continuously, perpetually in our mainstream media, we don't have strong examples of non-white women who are really active visibly in sport and celebrated at a national level. Do you think that is also a problem? Do you think that's another thing that is a barrier for participation?
Oh, definitely. I really do. Because a lot of the times, like we mentioned, it mainly from the USA, and, you know, they do great, but we need people or women, even men as well, that we can look up to from our own community, from our own country, to make it, you know, seem like it is possible. You know, I know we have social media, I know we have the internet, what makes things a lot more, you know, reachable, but we need to have something in the UK. And that leads me on as well to the reason why, you know, you mentioned earlier about the catwalk that Chantel, aka Miss Coco London, and I set up. It's because...
Yeah, sorry to interrupt you. Tell us a little bit more about what the catwalk movement is and why you set it up. And then I want to go more into the story there about what you guys are doing in order to bring around more visible identities of Black people and their history within a British context.
So the catwalk movement was just the idea for myself and Miss Coco London when we was away on our break a few months ago. And we did our walk every morning and we was listening to a podcast, and the podcast was really good. And it was educating us about Black women, but Black women in the USA. And like I say, amplify everybody. It is great and they do so much. But my question to Chantel was, is there anything similar to that in the UK? Like, we hear about the same names that come up over and over again, but, you know, as both of us being in education, because she's also a teacher as well, where are our Black women or even Black people or BAME or whatever, you know, in the UK that are doing, you know, just as well? We need to amplify. Why are they not being amplified? And so we came back and we came back to the UK and we decided that, you know what, the idea that we had actually was on the 8th of August. So it was literally a month ago that we, on that day, we brainstormed some ideas and it was going really well. Then we came back and said, yeah, we need to do this. We still had that same passion and we still wanted to find out about where are our Black women, where are our Black people that we can amplify that are doing really, that have done and are doing great jobs, not even job, but just having great roles within the community, activism, you know, whether they've been the first person to do X, Y, or Z, where are these people? So what we are doing now is we've created a podcast. We've got a website now as well.
Do you want to talk a little bit about Sharon Atkins and the significance? Because I think it was an interesting point of British history, right, that I think needs to be raised visibly. So do you want to just mention the little brief synopsis to give people a teaser?
Yeah, so as I was going to say, so basically this month's theme is making Black women visible. So the invisible Black women visible. So taking away the IN and making them visible now, amplifying who they are. So our first podcast was dedicated to Sharon Atkins, who until we did the research, I didn't know about her. You know, so she was in she's in politics, and because she stood up for something that she believed in, she was literally wiped off everywhere. You know, you can normally find people on Google. You can, we struggle to find, to even find an image of her.
Yeah, wow.
So we definitely needed to make her visible. And then we've gone on to do other podcasts. So this week one was about Claudia Jones. And so we're really, and for me, it helps me help other people. And we're like I said, mentioned, we're both educators, and so I'm educating. I say that we're educating ourselves every step of the way. So what the catwalk movement is primarily about is encouraging women or just people in general to go on walking yeah. if you know, and having that time for yourself, not going to walk to work or to walk to the shop, but just taking some time out just to walk. Like, I went on a walk the other day and some men were passing by and they said, why are you not jogging? Because I want to walk. But life is so fast paced already. I just want to take some time and walk and not having to think about anything, not just walk for me and just be me. And so that is what the podcast is all about. Like, people can sign up for the newsletter where they'll find like affirmations. We're doing different things weekly and what they can do for both their physical health and their mental health. So it's only just beginning. And so we just, you know, we're going to go from strength to strength.
Yeah, no, I really love the concept and I think it's so powerful. And I think, you know, next time you see those men, ask them why they're not jogging. Like, what are they doing? You can they not go jogging too? They should be jogging instead of running their mouths.
They were riding their bikes. They were riding them past me. But but you know, the thing about it as well, because walking, because of obviously the lockdown, no gyms were open. So for me, walking has become my new thing for physical activity, and it's helped maintain my weight, it's helped maintain my sanity, it's just been so much, done so much for me. And so it's really fitting that we have now come up with the catwalk project, or the catwalk movement, shall I say. And the reason why it's called the catwalk is because we are all role models, and we're all role models on the catwalk. And when you walk on the catwalk, you walk with your head held high, your chest out. And that's how we want women, people to walk when they're on this walk. Just be proud of who they are. And you're a role model to somebody. You know, we're all role models to somebody.
Yeah, no, I think what you're talking about there is a kind of a visible form of accountability, right? Being very conscious about what is it that I'm doing and how does it affect other people, right? Being a lot more deliberate and cognizant of how you're using your platform and what that does for other people. And I think at this moment in time in the world, that's so needed. And I think for all of us to feel like that gives you a sense of empowerment and responsibility that helps you to just make better choices and pause and reflect on how you affect other people. And so whilst we're kind of in the mind frame of pausing and reflecting, I now just want us to take some time and be deliberate about the things that have taught you, the valuable lessons that you have that have got you to set up, you know, the great empowerment female organizations and really rooted in diversity, because I think that's such a topic at this moment in time. A lot of organizations are grappling with, they don't know how to get their heads around it. And I just want to try and see what lessons have you learned in your journey of testing, learning, building, and to get you there. So if we could just spend some time now sort of thinking about kind of key defining career moments or projects that really what they taught you and what they've made you be able to do and or maybe not do because you learned that they didn't go as well as you anticipated. So they can be in any particular order, but if you could just give us three, and I think this is a part where people will be super interested to understand how do they build themselves to, you know, be that focus, be that, you know, ultimate self that you are saying.
Well, I'm going to go way back in time when one of my first jobs that I had, and I didn't realize it at the time, but now on reflection, how much it has really helped me and made me understand that if you want something, you go for it and you can get it. So I was a help desk administrator. So I was always into IT, did my degree in IT, and there was a job coming available, but I didn't have the right qualification. So what I did is I set about reading a book for my journey, that my work journey from home to work was about an hour. Every day I would read this book, and I actually taught myself to become a Microsoft certified professional. And I was able to qualify to become a SQL Server database administrator. So I went from help desk to fixing computers, like grabbing on the floor, fixing, to a SQL Server database administrator. So if someone's computer went down, I'm in the server sorting this all out. But I had taught myself this. And, you know, at the time, I was just doing it. But now when I look back, I was like, wow. You know, I had a young son at the time. I was, like I said, traveling in for hours on end. But it just showed me that when you, like I said, when you want something, you do it. And you don't even think about all the bits in between, like childcare, travel. There was no excuses to be made, because I knew that that was the job I wanted to do. That was my purpose. So that's when I look back and I think about, when did I have passion and when did I have a purpose? That was definitely my first stages of having passion and purpose. So that was definitely one. And like I say, look, something totally different. SQL Server, like a whole programming language, which has had nothing to do with physical activity. So that was that. Then teaching. I had no desires to become a teacher.
I was going to ask you, the transition from where you were managing servers, fixing them, to teaching. Can we talk through that journey, please?
So I was doing the managing the servers, and then I took some time out from work to spend more time with my son. And then once he started to get a bit older, I said, okay, I'm going to go back part time. And then I had I have a really good friend who we kind of like had the same CV or resume, or whoever's listening, what terminology they use. And she became a teacher, and she's like, you know, I think you should do this. And I'm like, no, I was never like the perfect child at school. So what, why do I want to be a teacher? And I thought, okay, I'd started to do something called like after school club with young people and working with hard to reach young boys. And for me, I loved that. And they could see that I was doing really well in it. And my hands were tied. I was literally forced into becoming a teacher, like just do the degree. It's less than a year. I'm like, it's not what I want to do. I'm going to do it, but I'm only going to go part time.
Yeah.
And came to the day of my interview, my job, you know, was accepted for the role. And it was so exciting that I forgot about going part-time. I just went in there full-time and that was it. And sometimes when I think back, I was like, I can't even tell the story properly of how I really became a teacher, because it's literally like I just landed in the teaching role. And I never looked back since until 2015. And, you know, I went from being a class teacher and then I went to being a second in charge like a couple of years later. And then I went to a maternity leave cover for head of department. Mm-hmm. And then the head of department came back and I said, you know what? I'm not going back to second in charge. I want to maintain that head of department. So I went and looked for another job, found another job. And then it's just been head of department ever since. And so I got to quite a high ranking very early on in my teaching career because of, again, that whole having a passion for something and really working hard for it and just loving what I do. And I couldn't believe how much I actually love being a teacher, you know. And like I said, it wasn't so. And likewise with bodybuilding, I never had the aspirations to want to become a bodybuilder. But when I get into something and I love it, and that passion, the whole passion and purpose, and it just takes over. And that's why I'm so passionate about working with young women and girls, because to helping them find what are you passionate about? Because once you find that passion, you can just do whatever. The world's your oyster.
Yeah.
You know, you do whatever it, within reason, whatever it takes to get to your end goal, wherever your journey may be. And that may change over time. Like I've gone from IT to teaching to bodybuilding, to being a personal trainer and now being a life coach so it's just a whole array of different careers, but all ones that I love and enjoy, and they've all helped me to become the woman who I am today. So without one, I probably wouldn't be here now in terms of what I'm doing.
They were all building blocks, right,
to definitely
get you to where you were going.
I just wanted to put one point in, and then you just never know what those building blocks are along the way. You know, we plan out our building blocks, but it may not go according. Like I would not have said that I would become a life coach. I would not have said I would become a personal trainer.
Yeah.
So how, let alone a bodybuilder. My career was probably head teacher.
Yeah.
Now that's nowhere to be seen.
Yeah.
So, you know, literally just go with the flow, and those building blocks may change, but just keep stepping on them and you just never know where it may lead to.
Totally. And what I was saying there about those building blocks that you have for yourself, it's very clear to me from getting to know you over the last sort of few, I think it's been 9 weeks now, right? Very quickly, but it is clear to me that you have always had an inner drive inside you, right? And that inner drive has always been about empowering and enabling people to do things, because you've seen what that ability to be able to find that level of, whether it was resilience or the know-how, educating people, finding a way to help people get stronger. And I really love that, that you used your sense of, let's say, being in a sad and really broken place, a place where you felt you couldn't do something. You'd say to yourself, actually, how can I always find tools to get me to that one step closer of better? And then how can I then repurpose those tools to make sure that other people in my community who are coming up with the same or similar challenges can be able to do the same, so they don't have to struggle the way I did? And I really love that, because what I call that is a form of enabling activism, because we're right now in a place in the world where everybody wants to be conscious, wants to be cognizant, wants to be purposeful. But what I'm finding so interesting in those moments is that how many of those people are actually creating the foundation, the framework, the tools to enable other people to pick up when they move on? And I just really, that's what I think for me when I came across you and what you were doing really fascinated me about it, that you are a constant builder of tools for enabling and empowering people. So what I want to ask you, back to a theme we started with that you made in the beginning, what is the one thing you want to be remembered for personally, like your legacy? So outside of that tool building and that empowering of people, and particularly women of minority ethnic backgrounds, what is that thing? What do you want to overhear somebody say about you one day? Maybe your son, because I think we haven't given him enough love and a shout out, because he's a huge part of your motivation, right?
Oh, yeah. He's always been like, when you said that, I'm just going to just put a pin there, just to give you a little story about that, actually. So when I had my son in 1997, that was in the middle of my degree. And so I had him in July of 1997 and actually went back to uni in October of 1997, purely because I didn't want to have that disruption of taking time out to, you know, to do my degree. So even from then, I was like at the age of 20, I was still able to, you know, have those, that mindset to say, I'm going to continue. I'm not going to give up. This is what I started. I'm going to continue. So it just brings a joy to my to me to know that I was able to do that. And now, like we said, like my lived experience from then, from the age of 20, so not even over the last 5 years, from the age of literally age of 20 going forward, is you know, this is what I've been able to help people empower young women and girls, and even boys as well, because my youth fitness mentoring program works with boys as well, so it's not just females. But what do I want to be known for? I just want to be remembered for, you know, oh my gosh, yeah, remember Andrea with Focus CIC or with the life coaching? She helped me to do that. She empowered me to do that. You know, just to know that they were, whatever they wanted to achieve, yeah, I saw it in them to help them see it in themselves. Yeah. Like, you don't know what you don't know until you may need that extra nudge. And I just want to be that extra nudge. You know, nothing more, nothing less. Just as long as I can help. And I know that that's what I'm doing at the moment. Like, especially with the life coaching and some of the life coaching I do, I work with people that may not be able to afford it straight away. So I'm helping them just because I can see that they're their capabilities and that they just need that extra tweaking. It's basically, I'm being the person who I would love life to have. Mm. You know, so I know how it would have helped me. And so, yes, we need money to pay the bills, but sometimes we need to, money will come. I'm not starved, I've got a roof over my head still. And so I feel like serving other people, that's my reward, and I know I will get rewarded for that. And I don't do it for that, but I know it's an exchange. Yeah. And so if someone can say, Andrea helped me to whatever they want to finish that off with, I'll be happy with that, you know. And I know that's happened already, so I'm happy.
Yeah, no, I was about to say, I hear and see countless people say that. So I think you are living your legacy, and I think that is an ultimate ambition for everybody, no matter which stage in life they're at. So I just want to say, you know, Andrea, thank you so much for showing me. I would definitely want to say, Andrea helped me to believe that it was a worthwhile project and that I should keep going. And I want to say thank you for taking the time to come here to share your story in such an incredibly raw, authentic, and really relatable way. And I want to say, you know, keep bouncing forward, keep empowering people and inspiring them. Eventually, I will book in a fitness training session and I'm brave enough to face you.
And even in that, I'm in the process now of hopefully like building my own place of being able to bring people to. So watch out for that one. That's the next podcast.
Maybe we should do like an online fitness session, right? Like a corner live fitness session. Let's talk about this offline and then we
can do.
Yeah, I know there'll be things that will be keen to take get their hand at that. So yeah, but I just want to sign off and say thank you to everybody for listening to another episode of In Her Corner. I've been with the absolutely phenomenal Andrea Corbett.
Thank you.